Welcome, Jamal Abdi, to Takes on the World. Introduction here. I was saying that you've been the policy director of the National Radio American Council since November 2009, directing its efforts to monitor policies and legislation to educate and advocate on behalf of the Iranian American community, and previously worked for Congressman Brian Baird in Washington, one of the small number of Iranian Americans working on Capitol Hill. We have now, as anticipated, an extension of the talks between the P5 plus one nations and Iran regarding its nuclear program, and also, as anticipated, the opponents to any deal inside and outside of Congress that leaves Iran with any nuclear program are champing at the bit for the new session of Congress when they plan to introduce new sanctions legislation. Is that too gloomy a prospect?
Well, gloomy a prospect that Congress is going to block this deal?
We have Netanyahu, who has given open access to U.S. television to face the nation, and then this week on Sunday, saying Iran is the enemy, that we can't allow any kind of deal. They're threatening the world, not just Israel. And then immediately afterward, we had AIPAC issuing its statement, Senator Menendez, the Democrat, quote-unquote, from Cuba and New Jersey, coming out with supporting the new sanctions that he supported back in January, and Mark Kirk from Illinois, one of the biggest recipients of pro-Israel funding, saying the same thing. What are the prospects of continuing the legislation? Obviously, the administration wants to go forward with it, and they seem to be fairly close, at least close enough to continuing the negotiations, but it seems that there's going to be a war in Washington, and it's going to be... there are folks there who want a war with Iran, clearly. It's not just more sanctions. They want a regime change. How do we deal with that?
Well, look, there are a lot of stakeholders in this process. You know, I mean, setting aside all of the issues that you just outlined, there are also stakeholders who are actually at the table in the negotiations who have to first come to an agreement, and that's going to be pretty darn tough to get to. I think it's possible. I think they got really close this last time. I think they've got 4 months until they're supposed to hammer out a framework agreement, and then they have 3 more months to actually finalize that agreement and start moving towards implementation. So basically, between now and July 1, we need to get a deal and start implementing it. I think it's possible as far as the people who are at the table are concerned, Iran, the United States, the other P5 plus one countries. I also think that if this was just up to the negotiators themselves, John Kerry, Javad Zarif, the other P5 countries, I think that this would be done by now. But what is weighing on them are these domestic constraints. The issues that need to be resolved are not really technical issues. They're political issues. So on the Iranian side, what is the size and the scope of their peaceful nuclear program that they retain over the duration of this deal? How many centrifuges do they have? That is a number that's being haggled over. The Iranians want to, at a minimum, keep their current number of centrifuges and just freeze that number at around 10,000 centrifuges. What the U.S. and the P5 plus one side of the table are asking for is for a reduction. They initially started at, they wanted Iran to reduce from 10,000 down to 1,500 of these centrifuges. Over the course of the talks, it sounds like that number went up as high as 4,500 centrifuges. Now, from my vantage point, 4,500 centrifuges, 10,000 centrifuges, it doesn't matter. I'm happy with either of the numbers. If Iran is limited to either one of them, they're not going to break out and develop nuclear weapons, and they're going to have sufficient centrifuges to move forward with the energy program. But the Iranians, because of political reasons, have concerns about going down on that number and appearing like they have caved in the talks. And so that this is a problem. They have to be able to sell this politically at home because they deal with their own hardliners who are already attacking the negotiations, already are attacking this extension as a capitulation, and so they need to watch out for those issues. Then on our side of the equation, the question is, how do we ease these sanctions on Iran if they agree to the terms of how they're going to limit their nuclear program? So the United States, we have a plethora of sanctions on the books that are, you know, really helping to cripple Iran's economy, really having a devastating effect inside of Iran. And the entire point of these sanctions was supposed to be, at least the people who helped get these passed in Congress, claimed that these sanctions were supposed to be in support of diplomacy and that these sanctions were supposed to be diplomatic leverage that we would take to the negotiating table and say, okay, Iran, you're at the negotiating table. Here is what we want you to do, and in exchange, we'll lift these sanctions. But the problem is that in order to actually lift the sanctions, Congress would need to pass legislation. The president has the authority to temporarily suspend the sanctions. He doesn't have the authority to lift the sanctions. And so what the Iranians are saying is, look, we don't think that this president, we don't think President Obama is going to be able to convince Congress to lift the sanctions. So we would be signing on to a deal, they say, where we would agree to take all these steps, but we don't have confidence that the United States is going to be able to take the steps that they're saying they can do. And so for Iran, they would make these significant concessions. They'd have to go home and sell these domestically and deal with all the backlash from hardliners. And then if the United States is unable to actually make good on the sanctions relief, the Iranian negotiators involved in this deal would have the rug pulled out from under them and have nothing to show for the concessions they made. So on the U.S. side, the sanctions issue, that's a political issue. That's not a technical issue. And the problem is that there are a lot of folks in Congress who, you know, you say that they want war. I think a lot of them just don't even know any better. I think that there are a few plugged-in Uber hawks who really, you know, they listen to what Netanyahu says, they listen to what the Saudis say, and they say, I'm with them. And even if it's at the expense of U.S. interests, I'm going to take these really hawkish policies that are going to drive us into a very bad situation. But the vast majority of folks in Congress, I think it's really, you know, an object in motion stays in motion. These guys do not know any better. They see what the party line is. They see the Mark Kirks and the Bob Menendezes passing these, or trying to get these sanctions passed. They hear from AIPAC and other groups that they need to do these sanctions, and they say, well, we've been doing this for the past 10, 20 years. We're going to keep on doing it. And unless there's an intervention by, you know, folks, you know, grassroots and advocacy organizations who can convince these members of Congress that this is the wrong path and that it will lead to war and that there is a good deal, but that that means that we have to give up the sanctions and maybe, you know, maybe an elected official, you're going to have to take a little bit of flack from AIPAC for that. But at the end of the day, it's going to be a good deal for the United States. If we can do that, I think that we can change course and we can actually make sure that we do get a deal. We've already shown that this is possible. We already, you know, we've managed to sustain these negotiations for a year. Groups like NIAC and the, you know, our grassroots and the groups that we work with, which is actually a very large coalition, have managed to beat back these attempts to pass sanctions and kill these talks. So I think it's possible, but, you know, it starts at the negotiating table, getting a deal that everybody can agree to, and then you have these other layers. And I really think that, you know, if that deal is brokered at the table, we can convince Congress to not just hold off on bad measures, but actually taking positive action to lift the sanctions down the road.
Well, back in January, there was a very critical moment when it seemed that there was a rush of Democrats to sign on to the Kirk-Menendez legislation over the wishes of President Obama and Secretary of John Kerry. And then, to her everlasting credit, Dianne Feinstein, our senator, who I'm usually a strong critic of, went on the floor of the Senate and made the remarkable speech, the speech of her lifetime, in which she began by speaking about how Iran could potentially be our friend, as former enemies have become our friend, and that a vote for sanctions at that time would be a vote for war. And that didn't get enough of a play in the mainstream media for the understandable reasons, but it did send a message to Democrats to stop signing onto that legislation, and it succeeded. But now, and Harry Reid was, as a Senate Majority Leader, was able to keep a vote from coming. But this is going to, you say, the grassroots are really critical. We saw with Syria that there was a grassroots opposition to U.S. bombing Syria, but there was nothing like the pro-bombing lobby, even from AIPAC side, that we're seeing with the situation with the sanctions. I just go online and I see the Foreign Policy Initiative, the successor to PNAC, AIPAC, WINEP, they're all kind of putting their oar into the water to block, to interfere with the ongoing negotiations. This seems a very difficult task for those who are seeking a just solution to this situation, from my vantage point.
Yeah. Well, I think you're mostly right. In the Syria situation, you know, AIPAC was lobbying for the Syria AUMF. Now, I don't know how aggressive or intense that lobbying was, but we know that the White House and AIPAC were both lobbying for that AUMF, and they got defeated by grassroots pressure. With the, you know, you mentioned Feinstein going down to the floor. Senator Feinstein and Senator Boxer have been excellent in the on this issue. You know, I know that, you know, some of your listeners may not always agree with what those two senators have done on supporting Iran diplomacy, especially over the past year or two. The two California senators have been among the most aggressive and forward-leaning supporters of this process, and really worked to protect the talks from sanctions or other sort of, you know, nefarious attempts to unravel a good thing for the United States and for the rest of the world. So, but as far as the sanctions are concerned, you know, that bill that you mentioned, you know, there's a bill Menendez and Kirk tried to pass right after we signed the interim deal last year. It was a deal that said we were not going to pass new sanctions. That was the term. Iran freezes and rolls back its nuclear program. The United States freezes sanctions, does not pass new sanctions. And immediately Menendez and Kirk turn around, and lo and behold, they introduce new sanctions that would violate the deal. And we had a number of Democratic senators like Feinstein, like Boxer, who came out and opposed that bill. But the grassroots did play a major role in that. We, you know, collectively, groups like NIAC, Win Without War, FCNL, J Street, collectively made approximately 1 million calls to Congress to oppose that sanctions bill. And that was that played a major role in preventing it from hitting the floor. Now, I do think we really have our work cut out for us. You know, we all know Republicans will control both the Senate and the House next Congress. I've been going over the numbers, and it does not look good. In order to get a vote on a sanctions bill, you need 60 votes. They didn't quite get that this last Congress. We had, you know, Harry Reid managing the process would not allow for the sanctions bill to come to the floor. I think that's going to change. I think that there's going to be significant pressure to bring a sanctions bill or some other bad bill to the floor, and it will get there because Mitch McConnell's not going to hold back on it. And by my count, there are 63, 64, maybe even 65 senators who have indicated that they might support a sanctions bill. So that's enough to get a bill passed, and it's actually just too short of the number needed to override the president's veto, which had always been the backstop. The idea had been, even if Congress ends up passing a bad bill that blows up the talks, the president can veto that bill. And now we are looking at very precarious territory where it's possible that Congress may even have the numbers to override a veto. And I think that's really dangerous. But that being said, I know firsthand. I mean, I worked on the Hill. I saw how this process works. And, you know, the expression that we have the government we deserve, you know, I can tell you it's true. I mean, when the grassroots is out there, when people are meeting with their members of Congress, when you have the groups that are weighing in on this, when they're active, it really does weigh on the decisions that are made. And these, you know, as was exposed over the past year, when there's pressure against, you know, blowing up these talks and passing these sanctions, even some of the senators who have been among the most, you know, staunch advocates of sanctions have had to back down, if not change their position outright. And I think when, you know, when we actually start talking about what the extension entails, the fact that it does, you know, it keeps these constraints on Iran's nuclear program, it trades in pretty limited sanctions. And frankly, if I was on the Iranian side, I'd be a little concerned right now that maybe I'm not getting such a great deal under this extension, because Iran is giving up a lot in exchange for just having some of its own frozen funds returned and then some limited suspension of other sanctions. But I think when this case is made to Congress, that, you know, you'd have to be a pretty special person to allow this to slip away and to blow this extension up and, you know, really have, you know, blood on your hands as far as blowing up the talks and starting a war. I think that that can be a compelling case that's made to Congress, and I think that we have the power to at the very least, not allow Congress to pass something that blows up the talks. Maybe it's some sort of compromise measure. Maybe it's Congress doesn't pass anything, but they vent their frustration through hearings or something like that. But I think that if the intensity is there, we can sustain the talks for another 7 months. My hope, though, is that we get a deal, because I don't know how much longer we can sustain this process.
One of the things that must stick in Iran's craw is the fact that Israel's nuclear weapons, existence of several hundred nuclear weapons, is never once mentioned, and not only by the President of the United States, but the U.S. mainstream media doesn't mention it either. And it's like there's no, that it would be like Iran introducing nuclear weapons into the Middle East. And maybe you could comment on this hypocrisy on the part of the media, not just the White House.
Well, it certainly doesn't help the argument that countries in the region should not, you know, should not be pursuing weapons programs when, you know, if you look at Iran, Israel's got nuclear weapons, Pakistan's got nuclear weapons, India's got nuclear weapons. In some respects, they're surrounded by nuclear weapons states. And so, you know, I think a lot of the people that are even on the side of this debate who say we shouldn't be talking to Iran and we need to go in and bomb them, they acknowledge that it would not be irrational for some people in Iran to actually be thinking they need to get nuclear weapons too. Now, I disagree. I disagree with the entire notion of, you know, nuclear weapons, but it doesn't help our case. It doesn't help our case in these negotiations. And so one of the issues that I think can be tackled if we get this deal, I mean, there are so many outstanding problems that are not being addressed because of the standoff with Iran. You want to talk about ISIS and Afghanistan and the situation in Syria, you know, the proxy war between the Saudis and Iran, all of these issues just in the region that could be tackled, but which aren't being tackled because of the standoff over the nuclear issue. And you can add to that the presence of a nuclear weapons program and, you know, 300 nuclear weapons inside of Israel. And Israeli leaders have actually said this. I mean, they're admittedly, you know, some of the folks on the center-left side of the spectrum, but have said, you know, you get a deal with Iran, and, you know, obviously some other things would have to happen, but that's the only way then you can start talking about a nuclear-free Middle East, and you bring Israel into that conversation, and you broker a treaty that does call for the dismantlement of nuclear as well as other WMD programs among all the Middle East countries. I don't see how you get there, though, until you first resolve this issue with Iran. And we have to remind ourselves, you know, Iran is a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Israel is not. So for Iran, that entitles Iran to a peaceful nuclear energy program. It does not entitle Iran to a nuclear weapons program. And Iran does have an obligation to demonstrate that it's program is purely peaceful. So a deal can do that. And then we can start talking about let's have these negotiations that have been put on hold for so long that involve Israel, that involve Iran, that involve the other states in the region, about how do we have a dismantlement of nuclear weapons as well as WMD programs in the region. I think it's possible, but it starts with these talks, and that's why there's so much at stake with these negotiations.
One of the interesting things about the sanctions and U.S. interests in the Middle East, we always hear it's all about oil. But as the case would have been with Saddam, American oil companies would be only too happy, also other multinational oil companies, but only happy to do with Iran's oil industry and have been prevented from doing so by the sanctions, which are essentially been driven international sanctions, essentially driven by the United States, was essentially driven by the Israel lobby. I know Conoco is the last company that had to cancel a contract with Iran because it violated the sanctions. And perhaps you could comment on how that is, how people can work around that issue and see the sanctions as not being so much an internationally driven sanctions, but obviously one that stems from those folks in the United States who are primarily interested in promoting Israel's interest.
It is really interesting how, if you look at the history of this standoff and the history of the sanctions, I mean, the standoff with Iran, everybody points to a different period in history. You know, some people will point to 1979, the revolution and the subsequent hostage crisis. Others will point to 1953 and the coup d'etat that helped to be organized by the CIA that took out Iran's democratic prime minister. And then, you know, I would actually, I think it's worth looking at sort of what happened in the early 90s with the collapse of the Soviet Union and how Israel's strategy in the region actually changed. And, you know, Israel, which for many years, including after the Iranian Revolution, when the Islamic government was put into power in Iran, for many years, Israel was still advocating for the United States and Iran to have close relations. I mean, you know, Israel, don't forget, took out Saddam's nuclear program in 1981 when Iran and Iraq were at war with one another. Israel was, of course, you know, famously involved in the Iran-Contra affair and brokering the sale of weapons to Iran. And there are plenty of, you know, less public pieces of evidence of how Israel was trying to re-facilitate contacts between the U.S. and Iran, because Iran was always Israel's natural ally. And a lot of Israel's sort of security strategy for the region did rely on a private partnership with Iran. So that all changed, though, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, with the signing of the various peace accords with some of Israel's neighbors, and Israel transitioned to a strategy aimed at actually working with the U.S. against Iran and Iraq. And they facilitated, you know, or they helped, you know, convince the Clinton administration to adopt a policy of dual containment opposed to Iran and Iraq and using them against one another to try to contain their power in the region. I say all this because you actually, there have been several times over the past 20 years or so in which there have been attempts by the Iranians as well as the United States to try to begin to reach out to one another and break this impasse. And a notable period was when Iran's president Rafsanjani was in power and was trying to work to facilitate commercial ties with the United States and actually announce that for the first time Iran under the post 1979 government was going to allow for foreign oil companies to actually come into Iran and invest in Iranian oil fields. And so this, for the Iranians, was an attempt to try to, you know, begin to repair relations, begin to establish ties. And through the pressure of the Israeli government, some of the, you know, the AIPAC and some of the pro-Israel lobbies, the U.S. response was actually to slap sanctions on those dealings and to threaten sanctions not just against U.S. Oil companies, but also foreign oil companies, to not take Iran up on those offers. And this happened, you know, this was immediately in sequence with the announcement of opening up those oil contracts. Then Clinton issued the executive order imposing those sanctions. Then Congress passed its own sanctions in quick succession. And it's interesting because this actually, you know, this was something that I think a lot of the oil companies were not very happy with. And it really, it showed that in this case, some of the sort of pro-Israel interest groups here in Washington outmaneuvered the oil lobbies and managed to slap those sanctions in place. And since then, there has been no, you know, no similar possibilities for those kind of commercial ties. With the negotiations now happening, I think there are a lot of people, I mean, oil companies included, but also plenty of other sectors, who are looking at Iran as a really attractive market. It's a middle-class country. It has immense possibilities, economic possibilities and investment possibilities. And so while right now I don't know that all of those interests are having a lot of effect in Washington and sort of coming to bear on members of Congress and others on why they should be supporting these talks, I think if there's a deal, you are going to see sort of a snowball effect with these you know, big companies deciding that, look, we need to weigh in now and make sure that this deal goes forward, and to make sure that if sanctions are lifted, it's not just the European sanctions and, you know, the to allow, you know, the European countries and Japan and South Korea and others to go in, but also that the United States sanctions need to be lifted. And so this could actually really be a positive thing for ensuring that a deal is actually sealed and made permanent. But there is obviously going to be a clash with some of the others, with the, you know, the pro-Israel groups, with some of the, you know, obviously some of the Persian Gulf states are going to be opposing this. And so we are going to see a bit of a showdown between those two interests, and it's going to fall on lawmakers here to decide what's best, you know, hopefully not just what's best for them in their reelection, but what's best for the United States, as well as, you know, American people, the Iranian people, and the world as a whole.
Well, that was a very interesting answer. You covered a lot of material there. It certainly it seems that the sanctions are not just have been against Iran, but against any country in the world or company that might want to deal with Iran. I know last month or earlier this month, there was a big meeting in London about businesses doing business with Iran. There are a lot of companies and countries around the world that want these sanctions to go and want to invest in Iran. My guest is Jamal Abdi. We're coming close to the end of the hour, but there's one thing that's going to weigh heavily on this. It'll be very interesting. Will be the presidential campaign, because Hillary Clinton has been much of a hawk, and has pledged herself as a power ranger to Haim Saban, and is very close to him. Robert Kagan is now one of her foreign policy advisors, the founder of PNAC and a founder of the Foreign Policy Initiative. How do you see this particular issue impacting the presidential campaign?
I think this is, you know, we are now entering, you know, we just got done with the 2014 elections. Now we are probably pretty close to having, you know, all political movement here in Washington sucked into the presidential election. And I mean, your question is going to play in the presidential election. For me, what's most interesting is how is the presidential election going to impact the policy decisions that are made regarding the Iran talks?
Because exactly. Yes, that's what I meant. Yeah.
I think both are really important, because for now, for the next 2 years, we got to get a deal. We got to start implementing that deal. And we need, if you look at the way this is broken down, you know, it's important that Democrats support the deal and support whatever is necessary to implement that deal. And hopefully some Republicans can sort of see the light and start to support it as well. But I think that a lot of how this plays out is going to be determined by who are the folks perceived to be at the top of the ticket. And as President Obama enters his final years, I think Hillary Clinton is going to sort of be looked to for guidance from a lot of Democrats. And if she is, you know, hemming and hawing or taking hawkish positions, and she's taken some really bad positions in the past couple of months that have, I think, narrowed President Obama's political maneuverability and undermined some of the decisions that the White House may want to make because they have potentially less support from Democrats. And of course, that's not just Hillary Clinton's fault, but her words have had an effect in that respect. And then, you know, you look at on the Republican side of the debate, you've got, I mean, it's really interesting. The Rand Paul is supposedly the front runner right now. I don't know how much of that is true, but Rand Paul is also one of only two Senate Republicans who has opposed new sanctions on Iran and who has supported these negotiations. So you could really see an interesting dynamic where the two people who are perceived to be at the top of the ticket for their respective parties are taking opposite positions to what their parties are actually practicing currently. So you'd have the Democrat and Hillary Clinton taking positions against lessening sanctions, against a peaceful nuclear program in Iran, and then you'd have the Republican Rand Paul actually supporting lifting sanctions and supporting the negotiations. And then, you know, that, of course, how does that play out in the presidential election is important because, say we do get a deal and we do start implementing it, it's likely going to be up to the next president to start taking the necessary measures to make the deal permanent. You know, I mean, hopefully there will be an effort to lift the sanctions before President Obama leaves so that the deal could be permanent, but it's very likely that his successor would have to be the one to actually authorize much of this sanctions relief and, you know, go to Congress and make sure that the deal gets made permanent. So the next person who's in the White House is going to have a big role in actually implementing this deal. And so how this all shakes out, it's really going to be affected by what happens on the campaign trail. I do think that Hillary Clinton, you know, if a deal happens and if advocates of this process can, you know, win on the Hill and win in the media, I do think Hillary Clinton will come around and ultimately support this. But I think she's probably going to continue to sort of keep her cards close to the chest and, you know, retain this position as, you know, being to the right of Obama on this issue. I also, you know, the other person who's thrown their hat in on the Democratic side is Jim Webb, and he, of course, is somebody who was in the Senate very good regarding Iran diplomacy. And, you know, I hope that there's actually a debate on the Democratic side about this issue and that it's not just a competition for who can run to the right of President Obama on national security and on Iran diplomacy, but there's actually a debate about what is the best policy and how do we actually achieve some of the goals, such as not just dealing with the Iranian nuclear issue, but preventing wars and wrapping up and winding down the other wars that we still have going on in the region.
Well, Jamal Abdi, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. How do people get information about you and National Iranian American Council?
So you can visit our website. It's www.niacouncil.org. So it's NIA Council, NIACouncil.org.
And you can get on their mailing list, as I am. Jamal, thank you so much for being our guest today and shedding some light on this very important problem.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Take care. Bye-bye.